My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm speaking with Alifair Burke. Alifair, welcome back to Portland. You're an old Portlander.
I am. Thanks so much for having me back.
The title of your latest book is 212, the numerals 212. It's published by Harper. Let me spell your first name for people. A-L-A-F-A-I-R. And Burke is with an E on the end. You were a Reedy.
I went to Reed College back in the day.
Back in the day, yeah. And you worked as a prosecutor.
Right.
What do they call it, a deputy DA here?
Deputy DA. That's probably, I might be the only person on the earth who has that combo. I went to Reed College and then I was a prosecutor.
Yeah, well, they probably obviously didn't ask you much about your past, did they? Okay, let me read a couple of things here about you that people might want to know. You're an American author. Yeah, that's true. Professor of law and legal commentator. The author of two series of crime novels, one featuring NYPD Detective Ellie Hatcher. We're about to talk about her. The other featuring Portland prosecutor Samantha Kincaid. Those books are nice, too. Sorry I've missed your last couple of books. That's a shame, and it's my fault. You trace your fascination with crime to BTK, the bind and torture killer.
Yeah, I grew up in Wichita, Kansas, and my parents moved our family there from southern Florida in 1977, I guess it was. And that was a time of chaos in southern Florida. And the one selling point to moving to Kansas, where I was going to have to give up the ocean, a concept I really didn't understand, was that it was going to be safer and nice, and we'd have a bigger house, and it was going to be like this very Beaver Cleaver lifestyle. And we get there, and we're unpacking the moving boxes when the local news announces that there's some crazed serial killer on the loose who called himself BTK, which stood for bind, torture, and kill. And as you may know, about 30 years passed before they ever caught him. So I grew up in a weird place, and the way my parents dealt with it was they didn't hide anything from me. So we would sit around and talk about whether he'd ever be caught and what had happened lately. And I think that that always got beneath my skin in terms of wanting answers.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's the Clutter family in Kansas.
Yeah,
the one that Truman Capote made his bones on, the BTK killer, and of course that little girl who was kidnapped by Munchkins and taken away.
There's something about the Midwest that it's like they pride themselves so much that it's safe that they convince themselves they're safe when these horrific things are going on, and they don't demand anything. You know, Portland's a place that the culture is protesters and questioning authority. And in Wichita, nobody thought to pause and ask whether the police were doing things correctly, whether it was normal that every few weeks some woman would be murdered.
Not polite. I've noticed that about the Midwest.
A strange place, yeah.
As long as you get out of Detroit, Cleveland, and Chicago, people are polite.
Yeah.
Yeah. In Minnesota, you know, even in the big cities, they're polite there. See if there's anything else here that we really need to... Oh, you currently live in New York City, and you're a professor of law at Hofstra Law School. As an old Long Islander, I know very well about Hofstra. So,
nice place.
One of the things that we talked about briefly before we went on the air, I mean, we're going to get into your book, but I think every city has a different cop and criminal justice culture. And, of course, you're familiar with New York and Portland. I'm sure San Francisco is different. I'm sure that Dallas is different, and I'm sure that Boston is different. But can you tell us about what's different about the way the cops and the courts handle matters in New York as opposed to when you were here in Portland?
Yeah, I mean, I come to it obviously as an outside observer to some extent, less so in the time I was in Portland. I actually worked out of a precinct for a couple of years and saw it more directly. But law enforcement shaped from the top down and also from the bottom up, and so it varies from city to city, but it also varies over time. So I know Portland less well than I did 10 years ago. But 10 years ago, I was very struck by the community policing model in Portland. And at least at the time, it wasn't just a label. It was a true philosophy that I think did permeate the department, so that from the top down and from the bottom up, there was, for a police department, pretty good public accountability. For New York, you're seeing an evolution now. So you had the Giuliani years, where I think the message that they got from the top down was that they would always be protected, that they would never be questioned, and that they had an us versus them mentality with the people they were policing. And, you know, Bloomberg has managed to keep crime low and has been credited with improving racial relations, improving accountability to citizenship. So I think the leadership really does make a difference.
One of Giuliani's pet projects was letting no petty crime go unpunished, even if it was just a squeegee guy on the street. Is that still going on?
The broken windows theory of if you police disorder, people will be orderly, and then that makes people feel safe in their communities. And
the Mussolini theory, as I like to think of it.
Yeah, I think Bloomberg still does it, but does it in more of the way Portland was doing it 10 years ago. So when I was part of the neighborhood police, neighborhood prosecution program that Mike Schrunk was overseeing at the time, we would enforce low-level crimes, but not actually punish. So the police might tell somebody to move to a place that was, you know, less problematic if a prostitute moved to another location, rather than have this very tough-nosed line. And I think that Bloomberg has moved more to that model, that it's more of an informal policing style rather than necessarily arresting on every single violation.
I hate to say this because it just sounds so retro and stupid, but I actually prefer the old dirty, sleazy Times Square to the Disney theme park that it's become now. I mean, I knew that, you know, first the Dodgers left Brooklyn, and then Hubert's Museum and Flea Circus closed, and I knew that the world was going to hell in a handbasket. I was in New York a few years ago, and it's so clean in Midtown that I could barely stand it. It was like downtown Portland.
Yeah, Midtown scares me a little bit. It is. It's kind of Disneyland meets the New Vegas with occasional splashes of fabricated New Yorkisms.
Yeah. That's too bad. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about the book. This is an Ellie Hatcher book. She has a partner named J.J. Rogan.
Yeah.
And he's an African-American man. He's been a partner for a long time. And because he's a partner with Ellie Hatcher, he has to have a kind of, a detached sense of humor about working with Ellie Hatcher. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, they're both pretty glib. And part of the way they come together as partners is Ellie winds up handling homicides fairly early in her career. And plus, she's a kind of hot blonde woman. And there's a little bit of resentment when she first shows up and nobody wants to partner with her. And I think because J.J. Rogan's a little bit of an outsider himself, he skeptically takes her on, and they find, you know, a friendship and a way to work together.
You know, why is it that outsiders always make the best protagonists in crime novels? Do you feel like you're an outsider? Is this some? Are they standing in for you?
Yeah, I spent my whole life growing up convinced I was an outsider. I mean, put it this way, it's not usually the student class presidents who wind up every college. You know, it's the people with a little bit of a square peg. And I think as I've gotten older, I've realized you get more done when you can be part of whatever institutional culture you find yourself in. And even if you have to fake it some days, you got to pretend like you belong in the sandbox. But yeah, there's always a part of me that feels like I'm meant to be somewhere else.
I've always said, if you can fake sincerity, you got it made.
Yeah.
Also, Ellie is involved with, that's the right word, with a man named Max Donovan, who is a assistant ADA. Do they call them ADAs in New York?
Yeah, in New York, they're ADAs. So she's got this relationship that she's not sure where it's going to wind up, but pretty good right now with Max Donovan.
It's also not the best thing to have known around the cop house or the courthouse that that she is in fact in bed with a prosecutor.
Yeah, she's still trying to be taken seriously by her fellow officers and by her lieutenant. And you know, one way to do that is to pretend you have no personal life, let alone that you're sleeping with this cute little DA. So.
I was going to talk about that. She rose quickly in the detective ranks. This is becoming a homicide detective in New York is not something you get in a Cracker Jack box. This is something you really have to work for.
Yeah.
And she, I guess, she nailed a couple of high-profile cases and got her shield pretty early.
Right. So in the first book in the series, it's called Dead Connection. And at the time, she's not yet in homicide. And an eccentric detective with weird theories about how to solve cases decides he wants to work with her. And it's in part because she has a backstory that's set in Wichita, Kansas, that is based very much on the BTK killer case.
What a coincidence.
Yeah. I wanted to find a way to write about that. Maybe we can talk about it. But,
okay.
Her father was a detective who was killed mysteriously after spending 30 years trying to find an elusive serial killer who's based on BTK. And in the books, and this all takes place off the page, but in the books, when they find this killer that I renamed the College Hill Strangler, when he's found, it becomes a big national story. And she winds up doing very high profile interviews on Dateline and in People magazine. And so she becomes kind of a little one of those 15 minutes of fame, real life celebrities. And that gets taken advantage of by the department, and she uses that to leverage her way into homicide, which is part of the reason why the cops resent her. They think she's a media whore.
You know, that's really funny, but wherever I've lived, and I've lived in Washington, D.C., New York, and now Portland for a long time, any good press that a cop gets, the police department is going to ride like a hobby horse as long as they can. And if this person also happens to be attractive and looks good on TV, it makes it so much the better. They're not above exploiting media frenzy themselves, are they?
Right. And she gets exploited by the department early on in the series, and that becomes the platform that she uses to get her way into this homicide gig.
There's a hearing before a judge early in the book where she's there with her partner and with Max Donovan, and they're trying to make a case against a man named Sam Sparks, who we're going to talk about in a little bit. But her reputation has preceded her with this judge, Judge Bandon, and What should I say about her? He's not very receptive to her testimony, and the lawyer that this Sam Sparks guy has come up with just attacks her immediately for being, as you say, a media whore. So this doesn't always do well for you at your work.
Yeah, it's funny. I have friends who are in law enforcement who are also writers, and they're always really reluctant to do interviews like this where they're recorded, because they're worried that the next time they're on the stand testifying as a medical examiner or as a cop, some defense attorney will have dug up the tapes and say, you know, isn't it true that you said this about your job?
You're on the Rush Limbaugh program and you said.
Yeah. Right. Or, you know, isn't it true that you're motivated to sell books and that's why you would want to make this high profile arrest or something like that? But I don't often include courtroom scenes in my books, but one of the things I like about the chapter you're talking about is as she's testifying, you hear about it from her perspective. And so you've got what she's really thinking compared to the sanitized question and answer formal format of courtroom testimony, which, despite the promise of telling the whole truth, of course, is not the whole truth at all. It's a very sanitized, formalistic version of the facts.
Yeah, well, what's the old joke? The law is not out. It's not for the truth. It's out to get justice. Or I believe it's something like that, you know. Truth and justice may not be the same thing. Yeah.
Right.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Alifair Burke, B-U-R-K-E. The title of her book is 212, which is the Manhattan area code, published by Harper. Well, when I was living in New York, you could get them in a 212 area code in Brooklyn and in Queens.
No,
They're precious things. I wonder if they sell them. You know, my Aunt Sally died and she's got a 212 area code. Does anybody want to buy it? Can you do that?
Well, I don't know if you can buy them, but I know that people are very jealous of it, because when I moved to Manhattan about 8 years ago, I got a 212 area code. And my friends who live in Manhattan and yet have the less prestigious 646 or 917 area codes were very upset. How is it that you just show up and get a 212 area code?
I know.
So it's block by block, apparently.
It's so, I can't even come up with a word for it, that you would even care about a thing like that, you know? 212. Well, okay, 212, though, is not an area code here. It's a building address. Or a building name,
right.
Not even a building address.
Inspired by the address.
Yes, and this takes us to Sam Sparks. Tell us about Sam Sparks in 212.
So Sam Sparks is kind of loosely based. I describe him in the book as sort of Donald Trump with better hair. But he's a celebrity real estate tycoon. And early in the book, one of his bodyguards is murdered in an apartment that he owns. And Ellie Hatcher's investigating that case. And she immediately has a battle with him that hopefully the reader sees is based very much on class, that Ellie's very aware of her blue collar roots and knows that she'll never be a part of that world, doesn't fit in that world. And his disdain for, and I saw this when I was part of law enforcement, that there is this elite out there that sees law enforcement and all government workers as
servants.
Incompetent as servants, that they're above it, that they should not have to communicate directly with police officers. It should instead be through their lawyer talks to the DA or the chief of police. They should never have to talk to a line law enforcement person. And so Ellie winds up getting herself in trouble with him.
The most telling detail that you put in, as I really got a kick out of this, was that he wants the cops to take their shoes off because he doesn't want them walking on his expensive rug with their nasty old street shoes. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know this until I lived in New York, but there are rugs that are art and worth a lot of money.
Then why the hell put them on the floor? Exactly. So you put them on a wall somewhere. if it's on the floor, people are what? Going to walk on it, right? Sam Sparks pulls strings. He has a lot of influence in town. And alas and alack, this is actually true. People do know, they know district attorneys, they know state senators, they know judges because they associate with them. They belong to the same golf clubs and things like that. This kind of thing go on often in New York? Is everybody in New York about power and trying to pull strings?
Yes, so D.C. is about political power and New York's about money.
And personal power.
And in this book, I think that they come together a bit because judges in New York are elected. And even though judges in Oregon are elected, there's sort of a behind-the-scenes appointment process, even though formally they're elected. And in New York, it really is elected. And so there's a lot of politics involved in it, and that gets entangled with money.
So right away, he knows he's got a weak spot in Ellie Hatcher, Sam Sparks, and he works that weak spot as much as he can. And poor Ellie winds up, what, in jail?
In the clink. she gets thrown in the slammer because she's in frustration during her courtroom scene where she's been attacked. She puts some inflammatory doodles in her notebook, and that wouldn't have gotten her in trouble, but what does get her in trouble is, in explaining why it's in her notebook, she says some things that the judge believes are dishonest, and lying to a judge is never a smart thing to do. And Ellie insists it wasn't a lie, but she winds up in a lot of trouble. You know, that scene was actually based on something that happened when I was at the district attorney's office. A then prosecutor, I guess I can talk about this, Randy Richardson, who has been, do you know who that is?
The name is not
He became a defense attorney who was later accused of witness tampering and has himself been a controversial figure. But he didn't get thrown in the slammer, but he had written something in a notebook one time that the defendant saw and the defendant perceived to be aimed at him. And of course, you're not supposed to communicate directly with the defendant without going through counsel.
Right.
And the defendant saw this thing in his notebook and freaked out and told his lawyer, and the lawyer told the judge, and the judge asked for the notebook. And I wasn't there for it, but hearing about it just kind of cracked me up. Can I see your notebook? And so I decided to use that with Ellie Hatcher.
My cousin's husband was a prosecutor, an assistant DA in New York in the 70s. And he said, if you want to commit a murder, come to New York. You get the first one free. Now, I know that's not true anymore.
No, that's changed a lot.
But it is true that he moved to Florida and is now making a lot of money defending drug dealers. So the idea that you work in the prosecutor's office, in the district attorney's office, so you can learn the ins and the outs of the law and then become a defense attorney so that you can game the system using what you learn in the prosecutor's office. This is way too common.
Oh, sure. If you open the Yellow Pages to attorneys, you'll see a lot of full-page ads, and this is in any state you go to, where defense attorneys boast that they were former prosecutors. Because on the street, the people who wind up in criminal court frequently, the repeat players, have far more respect for the prosecutors than they do defense attorneys. It's a strange phenomenon.
And the prosecutors are no more honest than the defense attorneys anyway in many cases. So,
well, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Person by person.
We don't want to talk about discovery and what goes on with that.
There are people with high and flawed ethics on both sides,
yes,
in my view.
talk about the penthouse apartment. A badly murdered, it's an ugly murder in a penthouse apartment. And this is the connection to the Sparks guy. This guy is, I guess, Sparks is, his name is Robert Mancini, Robo Mancini.
Yeah.
And he's Sparks' security guy. And the very first chapter of the book, we get a young woman leaving the apartment and calling it in from a payphone. There's still payphones in New York.
There are payphones in New York, believe it or not.
Okay, I'm shocked to hear that, frankly.
Yeah.
That starts the whole case in motion. And not to give too much away here, but there are threads of different cases that eventually coalesce into one thing. Tell us a little bit about how you structured the case, why you did it the way you did.
Well, in terms of where ideas come from, I'm somebody who does what if a lot. So I'll read a newspaper article, and without even realizing it's going to stick with me, you know, 6 months later, I'll find myself thinking about that case. But instead of it being the facts of the actual case, I think, well, what if instead it had been this? And so one thread of the book was inspired by a website called Juicy Campus, which was a place that promised anonymous campus gossip to be distributed online. And I started to think about, you know, what if you were a college student who loved gossip and you were on there being a voyeur and reading all of these people name names and call each other, you know, promiscuous and racist and all of these things, and then you saw your own name. So that's one thread of it. And then another thread of the book is about the mainstreaming of the sex industry. You know, when I grew up, everybody knew what a prostitute was. It was some fringy, broken woman who walked the streets, you know. And with, for all kinds of reasons, I think one is a cultural reason, but one is a technological reason. I think the line between mainstream dating and turning tricks has really blurred. And so one thread of it is about the online sex industry. And then one thread of it is inspired by a bundle of political sex scandals, including here locally, the Neil Goldschmidt case, because I didn't want to rehash the cover-up side of it, or, you know, it's nothing new at this point to realize that people who do good civic works can be scumbags in their personal lives. I didn't want to rehash that. But what I found myself always thinking about with the Goldschmidt case was the girl. To be 14 years old and to some sense have your first love, you know, your first boyfriend be the mayor of your city, and then watch him have this incredible political ascension and to have him, you know, succeed in every way in his life while your life is broken and you become a drug addict and you wind up in criminal court. And what I always found interesting about the limited amount that I know about that relationship is she apparently would turn to him. You know, it was not an adversarial relationship, even after she got a civil suit settlement, you know, and signed a confidentiality agreement. There seemed to be some kind of enabling, if not loving, relationship. It's probably the wrong word.
People are complicated.
And so that part of the story really stuck with me, and I can't say exactly how it fits into the book without giving too much away. But that one little thread.
The past is never past.
Yeah, things catch up to you. You know, I was watched with fascination as David Letterman gave his public mea culpa on the air, not because it's always there's something voyeuristic about watching somebody else crumble in public, but I thought it took considerable fortitude that, you know, he could have paid the guy off and that money to him, I assume, would be nothing. But to kind of man up and say, I'm not going to let this go any further, for me, was at that moment at least the right thing to do, because you can't bury those things. They catch up to you, as Neil Goldschmidt learned, you know, they catch up to you 30 years later.
Also, there was Elliot Spitzer, who was, you know, I said, geez, you know, he's going to be the first Jewish president of the United States.
I thought that too.
And he turned out to be an idiot. And, you know, I mean, it's the point now, right? I don't know what annoys me more is the obligatory standing before the cameras with the tears running down your face and admitting that you'd made horrible mistakes and you'd screwed over people that you love, or looking at the wife standing there like, you know, she's taken 400 Valiums and trying not to, you know, let any emotion on her face. We're in a culture of public shriving of one's sins. This is kind of awful, isn't it?
I don't know. Did anybody even hear of sex addiction until a few years ago? Now it seems like every other block there's sex addicts. No, I thought, you know, watching his political career go down the tubes that quickly, and then looking at his wife, Zilda Spitzer, standing next to him, and I think you described it well. She looked like she'd been put under, and she'd aged 10 years, you know, in a week, was definitely something that I drew inspiration from for the book.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on a standalone that's set in New York. It's very different for me because it's not necessarily a police procedural. The main character is a regular woman who finds herself ensnared in something she didn't think would happen. That's all I'm going to say.
The Hitchcockian idea that you take somebody and you throw them into something that they have no idea that they're capable of dealing with.
And then you got to find out. It came to me, ideas come to you in various places, but the new book was inspired by all the closed storefronts in my neighborhood right now. If you walk down 6th Avenue in Greenwich Village, you know, every fourth place is boarded up right now. And that wasn't true even 2 years ago. And about a year ago, it was at the height where every single day there'd be a new closed storefront. And I started thinking about, what if you were the person who had what you thought was your dream job, and in the bad economy, you show up and the whole place is boarded up, and it turns out something sinister was going on there, and it's all being blamed on you. So that's the premise for the next book.
The old joke in New York is that there used to be permanent going out of business sales, where there would be signs in a store.
There's
one on 14th Street, right near Union Square, as a matter of fact. It went out of business for 10 years, you know, without ever going out of business. But now,
some of
really
them,
going
I know,
out of
you're like, oh, I didn't know you actually meant it.
You're back in Portland just briefly, huh?
Yeah, today and tomorrow. I'll be at Portland. I'll be at Powell's tonight at 7:30, and I'll be at Murder by the Book on Hawthorne Saturday at 4:30.
Yeah. You miss this place?
I do. I miss it a lot. I did a TV show this morning, and then I came here today, and I had a little 1.5 hour break, and I went to a coffee shop called Three Friends Coffee Shop right on 12th Avenue. And, you know, it's just funky in ways that you could have dropped me from a plane and stuck me there, and I would have known exactly that I was in Portland.
Yeah, you know, as a hipster victim myself in New York for years and years, the whole hip scene is so different here than it is in New York. It's really quite amazing.
Yeah, it's very funny. Somebody who was in there must not have been from Portland or new to Portland, because I overheard them say, oh, I like this place. It really reminds me of the East Village in New York. And I wanted to say, no, it really doesn't at all. Yeah. It reminds me of Portland.
Too few cockroaches, for one thing. It's always wonderful to talk to you. I've been speaking with Alafair Burke, first name spelled Alafair Burke, Burke. The title of the book is 212, the numerals 212, published by Harper. Please come back with your new book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.